Afternoon. I'm Representative Connie Bernardi, and welcome to the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee in the Minnesota House of Representatives. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the House Higher Education Finance Policy Committee to order. The committee legislative assistant will take the roll.
Chair Bernardi.
Present.
Bernardi, present. Vice Chair Christensen.
Present.
Christensen, present. Representative O'Neill. Representative O'Neill, I think you were on mute. Could you just repeat one more time?
O'Neill, present.
Thank you. O'Neill, present. Representative Albright.
Present.
Albright, present. Representative Daniels.
Present.
Daniels, present. Representative Erickson.
Present.
Erickson, present. Representative Hansen.
Hansen, present.
Hansen, present. Representative Heintzman.
Present.
Heintzman, present. Representative Howard. Representative Keeler.
Present.
Keeler, present. Representative Cleavorne.
Present.
Cleavorne, present. Representative Kosnick.
Present.
Kosnick, present. Representative Kresha.
Kresha, present.
Kresha, present. Representative Mason. Representative Mecklund.
Mecklund, present.
Mecklund, present. Representative Noor. Representative Sandell.
Present.
Sandell, present. Representative Sandsted.
Sandsted, present.
Sandsted, present. Representative Thompson.
Thompson, present.
Thompson, present. And Representative Howard.
Present.
Howard, present. Representative Mason. And Representative Noor. And a quorum is present, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. May I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 3rd, 2021?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Sandsted moves approval of the minutes for March 3rd, 2021. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes for March 3rd, 2021 are approved. Members, we have two bills before us today. We will give each author a chance to introduce their bill, followed by testimony, and then we will have time for member discussion and questions. So the first we will take up today will be House File 1802 from Representative Herr, followed by House File 9, from Representative Greenman. Representative Herr, welcome to the committee. I want to be sure that, yep, I see you. Welcome to the committee. I'm pleased to have you today, and I will move that House File 1802 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Herr has an author's amendment labeled DE1. I will move that the DE1 amendment to put the bill in the form the author wants. Does everyone have the amendment? If anyone doesn't, please let me know. Representative Herr, please tell us about your amendment.
Madam Chair, the amendment is actually just to align our bill with the Senate bill. The Senate has already heard the bill, and so it is just making a language in ours to match the Senate version of it, which did pass out of the Senate committee.
Is there any discussion? Okay. Hearing none, I will, everyone, okay, excuse me. Hearing none, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion prevails and A1 amendment is adopted. We have before us House File 1802 to Representative Herr. Please tell us about your bill.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. Before you is House File 1802, a bill to provide grants and waiver programs for students formerly in foster care. I'm here to speak to this critically important issue of making sure all children have the right to access high-quality education and career opportunities. The Fostering Higher Ed Act aims to provide Minnesota foster youth with a last dollar in grant for the cost of attendance at any accredited institution of higher education in Minnesota. This is needed because fosters face significant barriers in post-secondary access and attainment, with the cost being the greatest hurdle. Just 2% of fosters in the Midwest were able to complete a two-year degree by age 21, whereas 60% of their peers have a four-year degree by 21. This figure is even less for a four-year degree. The Act would braid the federal, state, and foster youth-specific grant programs into a single seamless process through data available through the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, or FAFSA. In the rare case that there's anything left over after all existing funding is applied, we would provide a scholarship to cover the remainder. So a brief overview of the bill. There are three main sections to this bill. Section one establishes a grant program for students at post-secondary institutions who have been in foster care. This section includes definitions, eligibility, accessibility, assistance, and reporting. Section two establishes a waiver. What this means is that private post-secondary institutions waive any remaining costs of attendance after financial aid, scholarships, and grants have been applied for students who have been in foster care. Section 3 establishes a transfer of funds to the special revenue fund account established in Section 1. I think that it is important to note that Senator Rarick is the chief author in the Senate and that the bill has already received a hearing in that body. With that, Madam Chair, I do have a number of testifiers here today in support of the bill. These are individuals who have been in the foster care system from across Minnesota. The first is Christian Crump, and if with your permission, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to my testifier.
Hi, my name is Christian Crump. Thank you, Ms. Chair and members of the committee for letting me speak before you today. I'm a foster and I was adopted at the age of 16. I attend Minnesota State University of Moorhead, where I'm currently double majoring in physical education and health with a minor in coaching. I want to be a teacher and a football coach because I had a great caring PE teacher and social worker while I was going to Wheaton High School. Upon graduation, I'll be the first in my biological family and third person in my adoptive family to receive a four-year degree. Despite everything I've been through, I know that I've been very lucky. I have support from my adoptive mom, who is a guardian ad litem. This meant that she was very connected with the system and knew to get me signed up for ETV and many other scholarships. So I have very little debt right now. Because of this support, I'm pursuing the college path that I want, and I didn't have to delay my dreams because of finances. I was given this opportunity because I lucked out and basically won the lottery. I got placed in foster care and later was adopted by some pretty amazing parents. A lot of other kids out there never got or will ever get the same chance that I did. I believe it shouldn't be a question on if fosters can go to college or not. Finances should be available and the application process should be simplified so that fosters who don't have a mom like I did, who was a guardian ad litem and was ready to move mountains for me to get to college, still have the same access to financial support that I did. I don't know if I would have gone to college if I was never in foster care in middle school and if my adoptive mom wasn't in my life. It is not lost on me how much luck and random circumstance played a role in my journey. My story could be much different if just one thing didn't go right. I support the Fostering Higher Education Act, HF 1802, because I believe every foster deserves the same chance I got. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And with us, we have another testifier, Ms. Goff. If you could please introduce yourself and state your name for the test testimony and your organization, if you would like.
Madam Chair, I believe Anita Goff just had some issues, but I believe she just joined the meeting again here.
I'm having a few technicals as well, so.
Madam Chair and Committee, and if we, until Ms. Goff comes on, we could move to our next testifier, if that is okay. We can come back to her.
Perhaps the Vice Chair could take over the control of the committee.
Yeah, okay, Representative Connisnick, we will have Vice Chair Christensen take over until I get my connected properly.
Okay, so our next testifier is Antonia Goff. Please share your name for the record and share your testimony.
Okay, now I'm back on, I believe, and I apologize for the technical difficulty today. I'm sorry. I got back in on my phone as my computer was gaining service again. So I understand that Ms. Goff is not on our committee hearing, and thanks, Vice Chair Christensen, for taking over. I will take back the gavel and see if Ms. Abigail Hackbarth is online on our Zoom meeting.
Madam Chair, I do see that Ms. Goff is on. Ms. Goff, are you? Yes, she is on. So, Madam Chair, if we could stay with her and then move on, that would be wonderful.
Perfect. Well, just in time, we're back. We're back in order here. Ms. Goff, welcome to the committee. And if you could please state your name, thank you.
Okay, I hope everyone can hear me. I had some technical difficulties, but my name is Antonia Goff. But I do go by ACE for short, so that'll be a lot easier for you to remember.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and the members of the committee. I want to thank you for giving me the chance to speak for you, speak before you today. Like I said, my name is Antonia Goff, but my friends do call me ACE. And I'm here today to support the Fostering Higher Education Act. I entered foster care when I was just a baby because my birth mother was practically a baby herself at 14 years old. My grandparents struggled with alcoholism and were not able to care for me. I was placed into a foster home and was adopted by the age 6 by the same family. Unfortunately, that wasn't a happy ending, wasn't the happy ending that I had hoped for. My adoptive family changed after the state no longer was involved and when they weren't looking out for me. It would be too much to share all the details here, but just know that I did try to get out. I told adults in my life, and nothing really changed until high school. I knew at this point that nobody was coming to save me, and I knew that I was going to have to be my own superwoman. I started to run away, and the adults in my life started to notice. It may sound strange, but I honestly feel like I got lucky. I just happened to land in Judge Ireland's courtroom, and he started to ask the questions that nobody would, like why was I running away, and why was I in his courtroom so much? These questions led to investigations, which led to court, which finally led me entering into foster care. Again, while I was no longer facing abuse, foster care wasn't able to grant me the stability that most children were able to have. The instability moving from school to school made it hard for me to maintain my credits. This is when I realized that saving myself wasn't going to be enough. I was also going to need to raise myself. I advocated to stay at one high school and had to push to get a bus to be able to bring me to school. I was able to graduate from Fridley Moore High School, and after graduation, I did what most folks told me that was impossible, especially for a foster like me. I entered the extended foster care system when I turned 18 and moved to St. Cloud, and now I'm getting my college degrees at St. Cloud State University. But even now, I can't focus on school. I worked 14 hours a week, and now I'm working in between two group homes. I am on my own, and I shouldn't have to be. The state told me that it was going to give me a better life twice. Parents are supposed to support their kids' dreams and hopes for the future. The state is my parent, so don't we deserve the same? Please support HF 1802, the Fostering Higher Education Act. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And I'm going to turn it over to our testifier, Ms. Hackbarth. Are you on
our
Zoom call? Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Abigail Hackbarth.
And you may proceed with your testimony. Welcome.
Ms. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for giving me the chance to speak before you today. My name is Abigail, but most people call me Abby. I am 19 years old and I am in extended foster care. I am here to lend my voice and support to the Fostering Higher Education Act. I support the movement to provide more affordable education to children who are placed into the foster care system. My foster care process started when I was 12 years old, as I was in and out of hospitals due to the abuse I endured at the hands of my biological mother and stepfather. During this time, I was forced to miss several long periods of middle and high school, resulting in a disrupted and deeply challenging school experience that made it difficult to catch up and keep my grades high. Despite all of this, school was a refuge and a place where I could just be Abby. I was able to read as much as I wanted, do Sudoku, and be a nerd. I finally entered foster care when I was 16 and worked hard to graduate. However, I only had a 2.5 GPA in my graduation from Dallas Cogato High School due to all the school I missed in my 9th and 10th year, even though I was a straight-A student my junior and senior year. Like an ambitious senior, I applied to and was accepted at the U of M, Twin Cities, NDSU, and SDSU. I was set to go to the U of M, however, after calculating the tuition and cost of room and board, even with the help of financial aid and scholarships, I realized I couldn't afford it. I was short $3,200 per year, and I didn't have a parent who was saving for my college, nor did I have a parent who was willing to co-sign a loan. Being on my own, I felt I would drown if I went into debt with no one to help. Despite this, I never gave up on my dream of going to college. I applied and went to Ridgewater Community College. I figured I'd be able to save up, and once I finished an associate's degree in liberal arts, I could afford to go for a bachelor's in elementary education. While I'm thankful for this opportunity, it certainly wasn't what I had planned from the start. When I turned 18, my foster parents stopped getting state support for caring for me. I was in extended foster care, but this only paid for a third of what they had gotten accustomed to getting. I was told I needed to leave on my birthday and was given 30 days to find a new place to live. I am now living on my own and having to work 30 to 40 hours a week. As a result, I am only able to successfully complete 3 courses per semester. After talking with my advisor, I decided to change my career path to become a flight attendant so that I could get into the workforce sooner. This is just a long way of saying that I have had to alter my plans many times to accommodate for my financial struggle. While I'm still extremely excited to be a flight attendant and see the world, I would have loved to follow my original plan to be a teacher. I know I am not the only child in foster care who has had to change their plans as a result of major setbacks. I'm also aware that we cannot get rid of all the life challenges foster kids face, but to allow them the same opportunities that other kids have only seems fair. Many of my friends receive help from their families, a support system us foster kids lack. We do not have someone to turn to during school breaks when we need a place to stay or to pay for college. We instead must apply for hundreds of scholarships and work overtime to even dream of attending school. Too often, for most foster kids, this is too much of a hurdle, which turns them away from further education outside of high school. I got lucky. I am getting a chance to go to Ridgewater part-time, and I am grateful to be a home health care aide. But it shouldn't come down to luck. I did everything right. Shouldn't this system do right by me, too? That is why I'm asking you to vote in support of the Fostering Higher Education Act, HF 1802. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I see that we have Mr. Murphy on the Zoom call as well. Could you please state your name for the record and welcome to the committee?
Thank you. My name is Juan Murphy.
Welcome.
Thank you so much, Chair, members of the committee. I so appreciate the chance to testify before you. Again, my name is Juan Murphy. I'm the founder and executive director of a small nonprofit that works with people who have experienced foster care to create policy change called Foster Advocates. While many students in the United States worry about the cost of their higher education goals, that is not a unique issue. However, what is unique, as you just heard from just three powerful fosters that we get to work with is that there are significant barriers in their post-secondary attainment and completion goals. Compared to other students, fosters are twice as likely to experience homelessness or absenteeism when it comes to school, three times as likely to enter special ed services and face expulsion. And most fosters, you know, have to move. And that usually results in multiple movements, with the average number of school changes being three. That is significant. It causes issues when it comes to credit translation, when it comes to having a supportive and connecting adult who can even guide your pathway to college. And nationally, the data tells us that only 3 to 10% of fosters will ever go on to achieve a bachelor's. But the national picture is actually far too rosy. When we look at the Midwest, when we look at our state and the states nearby us, that number plummets. As Representative Hurst spoke to, just 2% of fosters are getting a two-year degree by the time that they're 21. The average for non-fosters is 60% are getting a four-year degree in that same time frame. And the number is so low in the Midwest of fosters who get a four-year bachelor's on time that it rounds to zero. If you find a foster who graduated college at a reasonable time, you've just met a unicorn, because it is absolutely rare. But, you know, one thing I want to stress is that these low degree rates are not because fosters don't want to go to college. The data tells us that 84 to 70% of fosters want to go, but also you've just met a crew of young people where nothing was going to stop them from going to school. Not all the unfair and difficult challenges that they've faced. Fosters want to go, but also fosters need to go into post-secondary. That is where you're going to run into other people like yourself, other people that you can anchor you to the world, and meeting other people who you know. They don't have families as a result of their experience in care, or at least not families in the sense that many of you all probably do, that could guide them and, you know, show you how to navigate your space in the world. Post-secondary gives you the economic opportunity and chance to overcome those odds. And removing those financial barriers for fosters not only will increase post-secondary attainment, but it will also become a huge boon for the state of Minnesota. Right now, we are leaving $86 million on the table for the 5,000 eligible fosters that are not attending college. And to the tune of, you know, we lose $1 million as a country for every foster that doesn't go to college in societal costs, whether it's paying for homeless shelters, poor health outcomes, or, you know, frankly, jail. For folks that don't get that opportunity to achieve something else. And so, you know, to quote Frederick Douglass, I would just say it's better to build strong children than to fix broken men. And, you know, I'll just pause here and just say that this issue is also personal for me. I was in foster care, and I was lucky. Like your other folks that were able to appear before you, I had the chance to go to college. But 6 months after high school graduation, I was in a college dorm at Syracuse, and my brother was sleeping in a car. Our outcomes then reflected that. My brother faced the challenges and outcomes that you would expect of someone who faced those circumstances. And I was able to go on and graduate high school, become a teacher, found my own nonprofit. And the tragedy that people often identify is that my story could have so easily been his. But I think the real tragedy is that my brother's story could have and should have been so easily mine as well. And so I'm asking you to serve our children. They became ours when we separated them from their families. Even when the separation benefits them, we owe them a duty of care just as strongly as we might to our own children, as your own children. But frankly, right now, fosters have to have grit to make it, but other kids get to have dreams. Please do what you'd want for your own children and support HF 1802, the Fostering Higher Education Act. Thank you so much, and I'm prepared to answer any questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We have one more signed up testifier, and so we're going to go to that testifier, and then we will go to member questions. Mr. Cervenek, he is here. I heard him at the beginning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Paul Cervenek. I'm the president of the Minnesota Private College Council. This is a wonderful bill, and I want to thank Representative Herr and Foster Advocates and Wong Murphy for working with us to include foster students enrolled at our institutions or who would want to enroll at our institutions in this proposal on the same basis as foster students who enroll at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus. We support the general approach in the bill as amended, and we look forward to continuing to work with the authors and foster advocates and committee members and staff to ensure the specific language in the bill works as it intended for our institutions. And thank you for this opportunity to join in support of this bill and testify today.
Thank you. And do we have any other testifiers today? Hearing none. Is there any we see we have Representative Cleburne with the first question, and we have Representative Keeler on deck. Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One, I would like to thank Representative Herr for bringing this bill forward. I've worked with many wonderful fosters who are some of the brightest people I've ever met. And to know that their hopes and dreams could be fulfilled through a bill like this is really good. I'm happy to hear it. And I would like to just echo Ms. Goff's comment that the state is my parent too. I just wanted to know that I heard that. And then I also want to echo the fact that these are our children. They belong to all of us, and it is our duty to help them and to help lift them up this way. One of the questions that I would have, and I don't know which of the fosters would want to answer this question, but I'd like to know what other supports you would need. You know, when I heard Ms. Hackbarth talking about working 30 hours a week, you know, your birthday shouldn't be your 18th birthday shouldn't be a sad day in your life. It should be a day that you celebrate. And to know that you are now on your own at 18 and then trying to figure out how you're going to possibly pay for your education. So I'm just curious as to what wraparound services Ms. Hackbarth might also still be in need of to help make her college career a success. And then if Mr. Crump or Ms. Boss would want to answer that as well, I would be interested in hearing their needs.
Ms. Hackbarth.
Excuse me, Chair. This is Wong Murphy. Just wanted to speak up for a second. Sorry, a couple of the testifiers were able to only step in just between class, but I can reach out to them and ask, see if they are able to come back. If you would just give me like a minute.
All right. Any of the testifiers, in addition to you, Mr. Murphy, still on?
Yes, I think Ace is still on, but I know she's having some technological challenges. Okay, there she is.
Ms. Goff.
Yes, ma'am.
So the question that I asked is, what type of other besides these grants, what other type of wraparound services would make it more advantageous for you to be able to attend school and a college?
Ms. Goff.
Okay, I didn't know if anybody else said my name. I'm sorry. Oh, Ms. Herr. Okay, I'm sorry. I was like, wait, I just heard Ms. Goff as well. So, yes, this is me. It's Ms. Goff. I would say housing. That was my biggest concern as well, because I ended up living on my own. So this is my office at home, just because I had a similar problem to what Abigail had mentioned of the concern of going back home. Where is home for me? So I would have to work these many hours, and kind of, I was working as much as I was going to school, which was full-time, just to make sure that I had a roof over my head, so that I had a stable place to go, because I didn't have somewhere else to go to call home if all stuff failed.
Thank you. Do we have any of the other testifiers that would like to answer that question before we move on to Representative Keeler's question?
I'm here. I just didn't hear the question. If you could repeat it, please.
Okay. Representative Clevorn.
Thank you. I was just curious as to, in addition to these grants, are there other services that are available to you, you know, other types of maybe wraparound services or needs that you would have that we should know about that could be addressed?
Ms. Hackbar.
I have been able to, like, work really hard, and I'm very good at budgeting, which is one of my better qualities. And with a help from my social worker and my life skills coach, I've been able to find steady housing and get all the funds I need myself. So personally, other than help pay for college, because that's just one of the big things that really stops people from going to college. Other than that, I have been very blessed with what I've gotten, and I've been good.
Okay.
Did that sort of answer the question, or?
It did. I just wanted to make sure that if you...
Representative Clevorn.
Apologies, Madam Chair. Yes, it did. I just want to make sure that if there are other things that we should be considering in future legislation, that we're, while you're here and giving these, sharing your stories with us, that we are making sure that your needs are being met. Because you are our children, and you're the innocents, right, who have found yourselves in this difficult situation. So whatever we can do to support you, I would just like to know that. Thank you.
Then we have on Representative Keeler, and on deck is Representative O'Neill. And then we'll round it off with Representative Erickson. Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Herr, for authoring this bill. I actually just signed on to it. I am a licensed foster parent, and so this is really dear to my heart, but also I work in higher education and really work to make pathways for all of our students to have access to higher ed. And so I really appreciate this. A couple of things I guess I just want to highlight. One that I really like about this bill is that it's designed either consecutively or non-consecutively to the age of 27 with 5 years, because as we've heard, you know, sometimes students have to stop out to work and, you know, kind of rebuild their finances and then go back to school. So I do like that we looked at that and took that into consideration. And I will also just point out the fact that I know that we say on average our students move, you know, three times. Every time a student moves, we lose 6 to 8 weeks of learning. And I would like to assume that most students are actually moving more than three times, you know, at least in their K-12 setting. And so this is really, really important. I do have one question for the author, and it's in section one around eligibility. The only reason that I bring it up is because when we do FAFSA verification around foster care, when a student identifies that they've been in foster care, it can actually create more work for them to have to prove that they were in foster care at some time. And that can be a pivotal moment where they just say, this is too much, or this, you know, this paperwork is a lot. And then they don't even get through that part. I see Ms. Goff nodding her head. And so, like, I've seen that happen a lot. And so do we need to put any language in here, or just make sure that in the eligibility and application process that we're just not adding one more layer of hardship that is intended to be well, but maybe could end up being a barrier?
Representative Herr.
And thank you for the question, Representative Keeler. And we tried to write this language to be as inclusive as possible. So thank you for and seeing some of the hard work that the advocates put into this. I'm going to defer the question to Mr. Murphy, who might be able to answer that a little bit better around the eligibility. And so if Mr. Murphy could answer that question, that would be great.
Mr. Murphy.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Rep. Keeler, for asking this question. I think you're asking the perfect question. One of the goals here is to braid those supports. So the way that this would resolve and through our conversations with Office of Higher Ed is that currently In the FAFSA, you're right, you are asked about your involvement in CARE at or on or after your 13th birthday. Right now, FAFSA has all the information it needs for you to get any of the programmatic offerings that are provided through this proposal. So what it would do is it would take the burden on the foster of needing to apply to the FAFSA, apply to the school, apply to, you know, the American Indian Scholarship, the personal private programs, apply for educational training voucher, and it braids it, right? The one benefit of being in foster care is that we have all your information. And so when you signify that through going through the FAFSA, then what this program would do is it would allow to then trigger the rest of that development, and you would only have to apply through the FAFSA rather than multiple points. And because this is a goal to remove those barriers while providing that opportunity. And so, you know, we think that this bill does address that, but look forward to any other ideas that you might have given your experience to improve it as well. Thank you.
Representative Keeler, do you have a follow-up?
I don't. Maybe I can work with the author offline a little bit on some of this language, but I really, really appreciate you bringing this forward, and also to all of the students who are here. I see you, and I know the journey maybe hasn't been so great for you, but I'm so proud of you, and I know that many of us look forward to the awesome things you'll be doing in the future. Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is for Mr. Murphy. Does your organization collect data on whether or not foster children enroll in concurrent enrollment or PSEO while they are students in our K-12 system?
And Mr. Murphy, you can answer that. And I apologize, Representative O'Neill, for skipping over you in the series of questions, and we will get back to you. Sorry about that. Mr. Murphy.
Thank you, Chair. One, just want to thank you, Rep. Erickson, for your previous champion of our, previous work, around foster care data supports, and because of the work that you helped push the last 2 years to get data compliance and better data accountability for fosters who are in the K-12 settings to look at school. While my organization doesn't collect this data, the Department of Ed here in the state of Minnesota will have that data this spring as a direct result of the bill that you were able to sponsor last session. And so I will happily make sure that you are able to get that report, which will be coming out as part of the state report card that is in the dashboard. You'll be able to look at foster care involvement and then be able to see the number of folks that do PSEO enrollment or, choose any other college option. But I'm also happy to reach out to the colleges in question and seek that data and bring it back to you. Thank you.
Madam Representative Erickson,
So, Ms. Wigmark or Ms. Goff, did either of you enroll in concurrent enrollment or PSEO courses while you were a student at your last high school?
Ms. Goff.
Yes. Thank you, Ms. Goff.
No, I actually didn't. I ended up having to take a break due to surgery, so I was not able to have that opportunity. But if I had the opportunity, I would have. I definitely would have.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
So, Ms. Goff, did you know, though, about concurrent or PSEO courses available when you were a student at your last high school?
That I did not. I actually didn't learn about it until I actually didn't learn about it until I want to say about a year or so after I was done with high school. So I felt like that was an opportunity missed out. The school I went to didn't fit me the best. So I just kind of made sure I made my path through so I can get out of there as soon as possible so I can go do great things in the world.
Yeah, well, I thank you. You are doing great things. How about Ms. Widmark, Madam Chair? May I ask her if she knew about these programs or was enrolled in them?
Ms. Hackbarth, are you?
No, Ms. Widmark.
Oh, Ms. Widmark.
I have two last names. I'm sorry that you're in the middle.
Okay,
of
got you. Okay. Go ahead, Ms. Widmark.
So no, I did not. When I was in high school, I missed a significant amount of my 9th and 10th grade year. So for my senior year, I had to do a lot of 10th grade classes and a lot of 9th grade classes. And I believe I got a 3-credit course for a CNA at a college that has transferred over, but I didn't do any specific PSEO classes.
So, Madam Chair, my last question.
Okay, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Widmark, do you think that that is maybe one of the weaknesses within our K-12, you know, the 9 through 12 areas of grades that perhaps aren't, that information is not given to enough of our students? I see Ms. Goff shaking her head, so maybe she wants to answer that. Because that's really important that, you know, regardless of where our students come from, whether they're foster children or otherwise, that it's really important that our K-12 system at the high school level do tell children that these courses are available to take for college credit. And if they choose to leave the campus, they can, you know, be a PSEO student. Post-secondary enrollment option is offered at almost all of our colleges, private and public in Minnesota, and those college credits then advance you. So perhaps, Madam Chair, Ms. Goff would like to answer.
Ms. Goff.
Yes, I do feel like that is one of the flaws in the K-12 system, especially towards high school. I do think that you tend to notice that students do tend to get grouped up, and those depending on like those on like the higher spectrum kind of get the better opportunities. And it's like, if you don't meet that, at least at the school that I went to, if you didn't meet that or the criteria or you weren't a favorite, you didn't have those opportunities. Because I feel like a lot of those opportunities I would have used if I wouldn't have known. I would have utilized them to the max. I'm a curious person too, so I definitely would have utilized them. But I do feel like that's one of the flaws, that I feel like maybe that if I was able to have that opportunity to take, that my path career probably would have been just a little bit different. I probably would have had a better jump start in some situations that I wouldn't have to worry about so much now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you very much to the students, Ms. Widmark and Ms. Goff, and also to Mr. Murphy for sharing all these examples with us. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill, thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a few questions specifically about appropriations for the author of the bill, Representative Herr. And yeah, I'm just trying to understand it. So I'm not sure if this is supposed to be an open appropriation because it's a blank appropriation. The reason I ask that is because we don't have a lot of data as far as like how many students we think this will cover, what the average grant will need to be to basically, essentially, we're making college free, including a room and board, tuition and books for foster students. So if we're going to make college free, including room and board and tuition and books, tuition fees and books. So I'm wondering, how big is this appropriation? Is it an open appropriation? In other words, every single foster that applies has to receive the grant, or is it capped? And if so, who gets it, who doesn't? You know, you kind of know where I'm getting at. And then the last question I'm going to ask, so if you could kind of give us a picture of all of that, and then Representative Herr, if you could tell us just a little bit about, I'm a little confused about the private institutions, and Mr. Serfenik kind of got to this, because there is an amount that they're expected to just forgive. So whether it's scholarships or they're actually just forgiving that fee, that could be sizable because there's a kind of a scale there. They can't charge that student more than a certain amount, which is scaled kind of to the MnState system. So that could be a very sizable amount, which I'm sure that's why they're concerned. And they're legitimately would be concerned about all of that. So my question is, if we require the private institutions to just forgive all of this money, would that actually make them not so willing to actually even accept a foster into their school because it costs them so much? So those are my two big questions. Can you explain to us about the appropriation side and then about how that works in a private institution when we're asking them, well, not asking them, we're basically telling them by rule of law that they can't charge any more than a certain cap and they have to just forgive the rest of it. So can you just explain those two parts to me?
Representative Herr.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Neill, for your questions. I do miss being in committee with you. You and I have none this year, and so I always learn a lot when I get to hear your questions. I appreciate your questions, really good questions. So just so that the committee knows, we did get a fiscal note back. It was not one that we requested, but it was one that accompanied the Senate companion bill, and so they were the ones that requested the fiscal note. And in the fiscal note, the amount that is associated with this bill is a little over $5 million for each year, and it increases slightly each year after that. But I just want to, I say that, but I want to also preface it with that there are a lot of assumptions made in that fiscal note that actually that is very conservative, and so the note is much higher than our initial estimate. So I don't think I said these numbers early on, but there's and Mr. Murphy can correct me and can add on to what I say now, but there's over 4,000 children in foster care right now, and in the assumptions that was given to us here, that they assumed that about 563 students. So this is just based on that number, 563 students would go, and that's what this is based on, and that's what came back. And so, and you're right, Representative Nia, I don't know, because I didn't actually know to ask the question of, is this open then? Because if we get more students, what happens, Emma? Or if there's less, what happens? Because we do know that it'll take a while for foster students within the foster care system to even know that this is available to them, for them to get, you know, to have access to it, for them to utilize it fully. And so we don't, we don't believe that this cost would be this high early on. And then I would just say that, so we can get clarification on that and get back to the committee. Again, this fiscal note was not something we requested, but that came with the Senate companion bill. So there's more of it that we need to look into. And we just got the full note yesterday. And so I haven't had full, and it's 14 pages, and so I haven't been able to go in detail either. But I will do that and get back to Representative O'Neill as to how it's going to be a set dollar amount, or if it's going to be based on how we're going to fund that particular account. As to your question about the forgiving of the private colleges piece of it, Mr. Murphy and I talked about this in quite detail, and I'm just going to actually let him answer just in the interest of time, so that he can provide you with a sufficient answer for that question, Mr. Murphy.
Mr. Murphy.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Rep. O'Neill, for the question. Love to just answer a little bit more about the fiscal question. And then, I would actually love to actually pass it on to Paul, who I think will be able to address a lot of those questions around the private schools, who we have worked with very closely in order to get the language, where it currently is. So a little bit about the fiscal note that, the money is going to roll back into the general fund if any of it is unused. So that if there is an under enrollment or, there isn't enough of a draw on the funds right away, it will go back. It's not something that will then, be a cost to the budget or to the state. But also one of the things that, I want us to really think about when it comes to that fiscal note is that was drawn without some of the aid programs that are readily available to fosters. So this is by note a last dollar in grant. And so what that means is that any existing scholarship programs or grants from the state or federally must be applied first. So when we're talking about fosters, we're talking about folks who make on average by the time they're 27, $5,000 a year, for like income. We're talking deep poverty. And so that means that they're getting max Pell grants, they're getting max state aid grant programs, ETV to the tune of $5,000, which is the educational training voucher. And if they qualify for any Minnesota state specific grants that are based on identity or based on income, that also qualify first. This means that for at least a 2-year tribal college, the significant portion of that is going to be covered in the existing grant program. And so this would only come after if there's anything left over. There are some assumptions made in the Senate report about the number of folks who are attending four-year the U of M and private school programs that is significantly higher than current attainment levels. My deep hope is that that report ends up being true. But the reality is that we're going to need some time to help fosters matriculate and get to these schools, but also that a lot of fosters have faced disrupted educations and then do need some time at a 1 or 2 year program to get their grades ready to then transfer over to another program. But many folks, if they want to go into a welding tech program, I want them to do that and have the opportunity then to go back for 2 years, get a business degree later on if they feel like that's necessary and something that they would like to achieve. With that, Paul, I would love to, or Chair, I would love to, leave it to Paul Sir Bennick, who's the ED of the Minnesota Private College Council, to address questions around private schools. But I would just say that this is something that we worked with in partnership with all of our partners and REPR to make sure that fosters are given ample choices when they are pursuing college, that they do not need to have limits on their dreams outside of what they can personally achieve. And if they can get into private school, I want them to go there as well. Thank you.
Mr. Stefanik.
Madam Chair and Representative O'Neill, members of the committee, in our conversations with foster advocates, our view of this is a good bill, and we wanted our institutions to be able to participate on the same basis as students who would attend the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus. That's kind of the principle built into the Minnesota State Grant Program. A student has a grant at the U of M Twin Cities that's the same as the grant they would be eligible for at our institutions in the State Grant Program. And if this bill provides that same grant in the Foster Supplemental Grant to a student to come to our institutions will make it work. This is consistent with the values of our institutions and the missions that they have. And it's therefore something they want to do, even though, what financial aid director said to me when we talked about this is this will be added pressure on our resources, but it's the right thing to do.
Representative O'Neill, do you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, my concern is that, well, in particular, the private institutions, profit, nonprofit, that it's just what he said. So the pressure will mount and it'll just be socialized. So all the students, all the other students will be paying more, essentially, to cover this. So just want to make that clear. But Madam Chair, I'm wondering if you could ask our fiscal staff, because I'm still not clear if this is an open appropriation or if this is going to be, I don't know how this is fiscally structured. I'm not clear about that. I wonder if our fiscal staff could explain what kind of appropriation this is, because right now it's just a blank appropriation. And the Senate bill did say, or the Senate fiscal note did say $5 million, but that's only accounting for one eighth or so of the students actually in foster care. So it could be easily, it could be 7 times higher than that. So I'm just wondering what kind of appropriation this is. Is it open or is it going to be direct?
Mr. Savory.
Madam Chair and members, Ken Savory, fiscal staff. I'll direct the committee to the DE amendment in section 2, lines 4.4 to 4.6, which details the appropriation. And this is kind of a traditional direct appropriation using general fund dollars to the Commissioner of Higher Education to operate the program within House File 1802 as amended. So the committee at some point in the future would assign a appropriation amount to this appropriation, and then those dollars would be directly appropriated to the Commissioner of Higher Education for running the specific program. And as a testifier mentioned before, if the dollars were unexpended, those would then go back to the general fund. And additionally, to clarify more, the appropriation would establish a new base rider in the Office of Higher Education for this program specifically. So it's establishing the program in FY22-23, and then in FY24 and 25, the program will continue into the next biennium.
Thank you. And Representative O'Neill.
Sorry, really quickly, so Madam Chair, what happens if we don't appropriate enough? So then do they prorate it out to the students? Because it's supposed to cover, I know it's last stand, but it's supposed to cover basically everything so that everything is free to that student. Like I said, room, board, tuition fees, the whole works.
Mr. Savory.
Madam Chair and members, the issue of an insufficient appropriation is not addressed within the DE amendment. So from my understanding, it would operate in which the agency and commissioner would be able to do as much as the bill would allow, and then students would, then there would be a cap essentially of the number of students that would be able to be served. But there's no specific addressing part of the bill that addresses that specifically.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. That's all.
You're welcome. Okay, so now we are going to have a time certain at 4 o'clock, and we have two more representatives that have added their name to the list. And so Representative Kresha, and then we'll give you the 2.5 minutes, and Representative Krosnick the 2.5 minutes. So go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be brief. So foster care kids age out at age 18. So does their foster care status carry with them to these applications? How is that determined?
And you're asking that question to Representative Herr?
Yep, or to one of the testifiers.
Representative Herr.
Chair Bernardi and Representative Kresha, thank you for that question. I will defer that question to Mr. Murphy.
Sorry, I could not hear that, Representative Herr. What did you say?
Mr. Murphy would have the response to that question.
Mr. Murphy.
Thank you, Chair. So the way that works is that you can be in extended foster care after 18, but also the federal DHHS database, SSIS system, maintains your records over the lifetime of your involvement, matching it via your social security number. So when you apply for FAFSA, you need to provide those details, and then they're cross-referenced with the federal database. So if you check the box saying that you were involved in care on or after your 13th birthday, then there is instant verification about that. There was also provisions in the most recent 2021 Appropriations Act, including provisions of the Supporting Older Youth and Families Who Are Involved in Foster Care subdivision as part of that act as well, that then moved and clarified some of the confusion that some state systems were having on that verification system. And so now that's handled by the U.S. Department of Ed and is considered, the world standard when it comes to making sure that, folks are who they say they are.
Representative Krosnick.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Can I do one more follow-up, or am I out of time?
You're out of time. Thank you. Representative Krosnick. Oh, yeah, I guess he no longer has a question. We will now go to our bill author, Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi, and thank you, committee, for hearing our bill today. I just wanted to close with just a quick personal story, but before I do that, I did just want to address one comment that was made about how if certain students have their portion of their expenses waived, that somehow the rest of the students will pick it up. And the truth is that universities actually do, especially private universities, do a lot of fundraising, a lot of development work, and that they do a very good job of ensuring that students who don't have access to universities get to go. And that happens all the time for people who are not even in the foster care system. So I think that adding one more category of which we should be raising funds for to allow those students to go is not a big ask, considering what these students have already been through. And so with that, I did just want to close with a quick story that my husband is an orphan. His father was a medic in the Secret War and his mother a nurse. And at the age of 14, his mom ran the intensive care unit at the Samtong Hospital. They both cared for injured Hmong and American soldiers. Not long after immigrating to the United States, my husband's father passed away from cancer, a cancer that we now believe developed because of exposure to chemicals in the war. A few years later, his mother died as well. My husband and his four siblings moved from family to family and he ended up in a halfway house with his brother for a time period, but eventually ended up with family in Wisconsin. the instability and struggle of those who are in the foster care system is not conducive to taking the step of going to college at 18. There are emotional, social, and financial barriers to doing so. My husband did go on to finish his bachelor's of finance, bachelor's in finance and a master's of science in finance, but this journey was not easy. Those who do achieve this, I want to be very clear, they are the anomaly, they are not the norm. And especially when fosters come together and they meet each other and they're the people who get through this, they literally look at each other like they were the unicorns that made it through. Like everybody else, like worked just as hard, couldn't get through those barriers. And so I just want to be very clear that every child should have the opportunity to do that. And when my husband met me, I came with a network of family and resources and people who housed him and gave him transportation and loved him in order for him to get to where he is today. And so we have to create that system for children, students then in the foster care system. Otherwise, they'll never have a chance. And I want to just note that if passed, House File 1802 would not only provide fosters an on-ramp to adulthood, but increase enrollment. Though through the existing Minnesota grants, they're set to gain $86 million per year. This reduces the revolving door of foster care, incarceration, homelessness, and unemployment, which cost us millions of dollars. And the fact that whatever cost it is, if giving college tuition or being able to pay for this, that we literally save our states millions of dollars in the life of even just one foster child. And then in addition to that, you know, we are able to give them, you know, a future that will be where they will be self-sufficient. And so, Madam Chair and members, I thank you for hearing House File 1802, and I ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Herr. Hearing no further discussion in our time that we have here to move on to the next bill, I renew my motion that House File 1802 has amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the Higher Education Omnibus Bill. Thank you for your testimony. Okay, now we are moving to our next bill. And that bill is House File 9 from Representative Greenman. The bill has a number of provisions in it, but today we will discuss and we focus on the sections that relate specifically to higher education. Article 1, Section 2, and Article 1, Section 9. With that, I will move House File 9 to be referred to the Taxes Committee. Representative Greenman has an author's amendment labeled A15. I will move 815 amendment to put the bill in the form that the author wants. Does everyone have the amendment? Don't let me know. Representative Greenman, please tell us about the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is just a technical amendment, a minor technical amendment that the reviser sent over from its last engrossment.
Thank you very much. Is there any discussion? Let's see. Representative Creech. Okay,
nope. I think that's my hand is still up, so I just didn't lower it.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Kosnick.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And If the committee would indulge me, I just wanted to say a couple things. My mute stayed on when I had my hand up on the other file, but if I could just have 10 seconds on that, if that'd be all right, Madam Chair.
That would be fine. I saw your hand go down, so go ahead. You get your 10 seconds. I'd be happy.
Representative Kreisha threw me off, and he jumped ahead of me, but that was fine with me when he wanted his follow-up question. So, but anyways, I guess I'd just like to share do support the previous bill. I think it's scalable. There are some issues with the fiscal note and cost. And I did work with the advocate, Mr. Murphy, on the bill a little bit to kind of put some guide ramps on there in terms of fiscal cost. And I think there's an opportunity to do that further. So I think it does identify an issue or a problem for many people and something that we could hopefully support and work it out through conference committee. But to House File 9, Representative Greenman.
And you're talking to the amendment specifically right now, Representative Kosnick.
Okay. I'll wait until after. Thank you.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Seeing no further hands up after Representative Kosnick takes his hand down, I will. Hearing no further discussion, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion prevails and the A15 amendment is adopted. We now have before us House File 9. Before we have Representative Greenman present her bill, I believe Mr. Hopkins is going to direct us to the language that pertains to our committee. Mr. Hopkins, please proceed.
Madam Chair and members, so the parts of House File 9 that are relevant to Higher Education Committee are the residential housing list, which is in Article 1, Section 2, and in Article 1, Section 9, there's additional information about proofs of residence for students. And that's it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. And Representative Greenman, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. I'm happy to be here in higher education for the first time, and I'm grateful to present House File 9, the Democracy for the People Act. This bill defends and strengthens Minnesota's best traditions of inclusive voter participation and sound election administration. The policy rests on the premise that our state works best when the voices of all Minnesotans are at the center of our democracy. When all Minnesotans, students and our elders, Black, Brown, Indigenous, White, Greater Minnesota Metro, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, and folks with no party at all, when Minnesotans power our democracy. I wanna give chance for the testifiers, but before I do that, I just wanna give a little bit of background about why this is important. Last year, we conducted a presidential election during a global pandemic that required a Herculean effort by our elections officials and Minnesota voters to ensure voter access and ensure we had safe and secure elections. 30,000 local elections officials, our friends and neighbors from every county and every corner of the state showed up and put their health on the line to conduct a safe election. 3.3 million voters turned out to participate, but like other areas of our policy, the pandemic also exposed some of the inefficiencies and the inequities in our system. It also showed us what the things that voters like and the things that help us run elections run smoothly. One, the way that this bill does that is working to strengthen voter access for Minnesota's newest voters and our students at our colleges and universities. It's particularly important because while Minnesota is proud of our high voter participation, voter turnout of 18 to 24 year olds lags behind that of older Minnesotans. The two specific provisions of House File 9 under Higher Education's committee as jurisdiction work to address this by ensuring that students have what they need to register and vote. The provisions do one simple thing. It ensures that Minnesota college students can use their student ID as proof of residency if they choose to register on election day. It does this by ensuring that colleges and universities in Minnesota provide a residential housing list to their county auditors in advance, and ensures that students with a valid student ID can use that ID to use along with the housing list to register on election day. The vast majority of colleges and universities are already providing this list, and in those precincts, students can use their valid student ID right now. It's the current law. While it's a simple change, it's important because it provides certainty to students who won't have to guess if that list is there and they can use their student ID. It also eases the administrative burden on our counties. I heard from a few county elections officials that sometimes they have to spend some time to get this list. So this would mean that they have it ready to go and can focus their energy on preparing for the election. These provisions ensure access for students and relieve the administrative burdens on our county auditors and local elections administrators. It's a simple change, and it makes voting accessible and reliable for our newest voters. With that, Madam Chair, I think I will turn it over to the testifiers, and I believe you have a list in front of you.
Yes, I do, and we have three testifiers, and we will have each of them testify for 2 minutes. I want to make sure that we have enough time for member questions. First, we have Sienna Leon Getten. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thanks. I'm Sienna Leon Getten.
Please proceed with your testimony.
Thanks, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sienna Leon Getten, like I said, and I am a college student in Northfield. HF9 would be an important step in making sure that voting is accessible for all to want to participate. When I was a freshman in college, I was able to register and vote using my student ID, and this was a super straightforward process that allowed me to feel empowered to exercise my right to vote. This past year, I was a leader on our campus during the election, providing support and information to help students exercise their right to vote. However, this time, changes in requirements for proof of residency beyond student identification meant that students needed to request proof of residency from the college, which led to a lot of confusion. And sometimes it was a lengthy process. So I've seen that each additional step can dissuade students from participating in our democratic process. And since college students are often voting for the first time, and there's a need for accessibility and consistency about what identification they need to register and cast their ballot to make it so that they also feel empowered to vote and make their voices heard. The voices of young people are often underrepresented in a voting population, and making voting accessible for folks to start participating once they're eligible is crucial to building and maintaining a healthy democracy. So I urge you to support HF9. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sean Lim, welcome to the committee.
Hi, all.
Can I hope I, yes, I can. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you, Madam Chair and the Higher Ed Committee for having me. My name is Sean Lim. I'm 21 years old, and I'm currently serving as the lead campus organizer for the nonprofit Minnesota Youth Collective. As an electoral youth and community organizer, I help provide students and young folks aged 18 to 36 with the tools and the knowledge that they need to successfully participate in our elections, including walking them through the voter registration process and getting them to the polls. And so I'm here today to testify in favor of House File 9. I'm a strong proponent of the provision requiring that all universities receiving public funds provide essential resident housing lists so that students living around campus in a 10-mile radius can use their university ID to vote. Mine looks like this. It is both safe and secure. I've had many folks on campus be unsure of what they need to bring with them to the ballot box, as well as other points of confusion and difficulty, especially freshman students and people who have just moved into student housing and dorms on their respective campuses. And so with this bill, by allowing students to show up and vote with their campus ID, the provision greatly streamlines the voter registration process and voting process on campus. It simplifies it for voters and organizers like me alike, and it saves a lot of time and energy for election judges, and it also greatly reduces the long lines that we see in our densely populated neighborhoods on the Twin Cities campus here at the U of M. It would mitigate confusion and make the process more accessible for young voters. I firmly believe that right now, many young voters are not aware of what they need to bring, for example, a proof of residence, like a housing lease or a utility bill. So this simplifies the process when they come in person, last minute, and day of. The fact of the matter is, higher education institutions already have our relevant information, our addresses, full names, and everything else. They can just turn this over to the precincts and make the process easier. The U of M has done this in recent years, and it has helped a lot of students. This would simply expand current practices and make it more uniform. For countless students that I've talked to personally, being able to use their U cards from their wallet and just take it out as a form of ID has made it infinitely easier to vote, and it incentivizes people to vote. Voters who are participating in their first election, 18-year-olds, are more likely to consistently vote in every other election for the rest of their lives. So I truly believe that regardless of party, for young people in the state, there are a lot of barriers to participation right now. I believe that young people have the power to, as the fastest growing voter bloc, be the most influential in our electoral outcomes. But as people have said, young people do not turn out. At our campus specifically, only 58.7% turned out in the 2018 midterms. And this is considered to be the highest amongst the large US colleges. So there's a long way to go in ensuring that all eligible students have the opportunity to have their voice heard. And this is a step in the right direction, one that will increase voters, the number of voters coming out in each election. And it fundamentally sets the foundational groundwork for a more representative democracy. It facilitates and encourages us to perform our civic duty. So I support this legislation. I urge you all and your colleagues to do so as well. Thank you for your time and consideration. I yield back.
Thank you. We have Will Burris with us. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair. So my name is William Burns, and I'm a student at the University of Minnesota. First of all, I believe that voting is the most impactful thing that you can do while you're in college to enact change. As students who are, you know, we're young people who have recently moved to new towns and still looking for a place in our community, it doesn't really feel like we have a lot of influence outside of the voting process. And even though voter turnout rates on college campuses are rising, we're still nowhere near where we need to be in order to feel represented and like we're a part of the process. So as long as I've been a student, I've voted in my hometown, which is Woodbury, Minnesota. And I've mostly done this because the process is clear to me. Like, I know where to vote. I know what I need to vote. And I know that I'm already registered to vote being at my parents' house. And I've also seen a lot of my friends and peers at the U of M do this, both who live in state and out of state. I know that students from what I've talked to and who I know, they don't lack passion or desire for positive change in our communities, but rather because we lack an accessible process to register in the new place that we call home when we go to college. And I feel like it's important that we're able to have a say in the candidates and causes that impact our daily lives on college campuses. And if we're voting back in our hometown or where we were previously registered, we're not providing that input to the candidates that represent us. With this provision, I feel that it would make it more clear to students like me who live both on and off campuses what we need in order to register to vote. It would make the process more accessible and more welcoming for those of us who are trying to navigate this new chapter of our lives. I believe that this would foster a new sense of investment for students and the outcomes of local elections and in our community. So to wrap up, I support House File 9 and the increased access that it would grant college students in our electoral processes, and I hope you will too. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have four members that have questions, and we will start with Representative Kosnick, and we will go to a vote at 4:30, or excuse me, a little bit before 4:30, 4:28 or 29-ish. And so, I see. Okay, so we have three members that have questions. So we have about 4 minutes for each member. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just really quickly, I wonder if the author could tell us about the safeguards. So in the bill or in existing law, either one, where say a foreign student that came here from Japan can't vote in our elections and disenfranchise those that are citizens. I'm wondering if you could tell me that. And then also, what are the safeguards to not vote in two places? So vote here at your college campus and then, you know, do a mail-in ballot or something in the home, like your parents' home. So what are the safeguards for those two? Thank you.
And which of our testifiers would like to answer that question?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Representative Greenman.
thank you, Representative. All the safeguards are in place that are in the place for every other voter. We do have somebody from the Secretary of State's office, I think Sam Bonowitz, who can address that probably better than I can. So let me turn it over to her.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and your organization.
Chair and members, my name is Sam Bonowitz. I am Director of Government Relations with the Office of the Secretary of State. Representative Greenman is correct. The same checks that are in place right now for every other voter checking against the Social Security Administration driver's license, courts, USPS, all that still remains for these voters as well. And voters on Election Day sign that roster oath as well.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. Just quickly, Madam Chair. So they're basically saying that the student ID could be like a second ID, because if you're checking it against all these other registration, like the Social Security list and things like that. So is that what you're trying to say to the testifier?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Ms. Greenman, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and I am happy to turn it back over to Ms. Bonowitz, but this is just a proof of residency, like all of the other, the student ID plus the voter list, plus the residential housing list is a proof of residency, like a student fee bill, like other things we have. And Ms. Bonowitz, if you want to add anything additional.
Ms. Bonowitz.
Chair members, yeah, I would just say that the voter registration form still includes a space for driver's license or social security number if they have that. And so that is what is checked against those.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill, did you have a follow-up?
No, I see Representative Kosnick now has a question, so I'm going to defer to him.
Okay, so Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Greenman, for bringing the bill forward, you know, and to all the testifiers. And I would really hope that we sort of come at this from the perspective of voter participation amongst our youth as a good thing. It's something we should look at finding ways to reduce barriers. And that is my question for the bill author or the testifiers. What do we know about sort of voter participation amongst youth versus the general population?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Howard, for the question. And I think that probably all of our testifiers, to a certain degree, spoke to it. In the 2018 election, what we know is, despite having pretty high turnout and increasing turnout, as I think Mr. Burns mentioned, 42.7% of 18 to 24-year-olds turned out versus 81.6% of the highest turnout, which was 65 to 74-year-olds. And so, and it looks like the trends in the 2020 election will hold, but the data is a little new. And so what we know is that while in Minnesota we have great and really robust voter participation, 42% in a congressional year of 18 to 24-year-olds only voted. So we have work to do, and I think what we heard from the testifiers is there is real interest and urgency to do that. So appreciate the question.
Okay. Representative Howard, I see Representative Cosner has his name up, and so I wanted to go. Did you have a follow-up really quick?
Just very quickly, thank you for the answer. And again, under the premise that hopefully we're approaching this with some shared understanding that we want to increase voter participation, this provision in this bill is a good way to do that, to reduce barriers, to make sure that Minnesotans that want to participate can vote. Thanks.
Thank you. And then Representative Kosnick, did you accidentally lower your hand?
I was trying to be polite and lower my hand as you called on me, and then you skipped over me a couple of times, but that's no problem. No, I have some comments to make, Madam Chair.
Okay, and so proceed.
Well, thank you, and committee members and those watching.
And Representative Kosnick, I just want to let you know, when I divided that time out, I divided it among the three people, and I apologize that your name hand wasn't up, so I just want to let you know that we have about 3 minutes for that, so thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Go ahead.
Members, and you know, I've heard this bill. This is my third time, so congratulations to you, Representative Greenman, on you know the field trip around the committee stops, especially in your freshman year. But let's not lose sight that this is like an over $216 million bill that's probably not going anywhere beyond the House floor. And essentially, what we're doing here is creating welfare for politicians with the new cost to the campaign finance board. And I'm not sure, I've heard this bill enough, that I don't think this bill really fixes a particular problem.
other than providing additional campaign welfare for politicians. And we've heard from the advocates that are stand to have their work done for them with more automated registration that is controversial. And it funds progressive politics and their advocates. And there was very little addition to election integrity and the sanctity of the vote. And that was really the crucial issue that we saw in the last election. It wasn't voter turnout. As I spoke with Secretary of State Simons this morning, for the third year in a row, Minnesota's had the highest turnout, voter turnout. And so I think we're doing some things really good, but this bill is just simply a massive bailout. And it's astonishing. It doesn't do anything to address the real issue of the last election. The issue that I hear from my constituents is, how are we going to improve voter integrity and election integrity and the integrity and sanctity of a vote? And so, again, I will congratulate Representative Greenman for making the rounds with this bill. But there is a individual responsibility that is not too much to ask to have people participate in the Republican, Democratic process, registering to vote, knowing where to vote, knowing who's on the ballot, and upholding the principles of democracy with a little bit of individual responsibility, and certainly not by increasing and passing a bill that's over $200 million in cost when we're already the first highest voter turnout in the state. So I appreciate the efforts. I really do. You've done a good job for your side, Representative Greenman, but this bill just certainly is too expensive and goes too far. It doesn't address the main issue of voter integrity and election integrity.
Okay, so Representative Mecklen, you get 2 minutes.
Can I respond to that?
If you'd like to, actually, Representative Greenman, we were going to let Representative Mecklen. We're going to Representative Mecklen. Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. I have a question for two of the testifiers, Sean Lim and William Burns. Are your parents, so I sent a kid to college, so are your parents allowed to claim you as a dependent while you're at college? And I asked that question because I did. That was the case, and the young man came home and voted. So I'm just kind of curious if your parents are allowed to claim you as a dependent.
Okay, which person did you want to ask that question to?
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Representative Cleaver.
Yeah, just a point of personal privilege. I don't know that their financial records should be spoken about.
Representative Cleavorn. So Representative Mecklen, can you just repeat your question for one of the testifiers, please?
So thank you, Chair Bernardi. So what it comes down to is, where is your residence, right? So, we sent a kid away to college. We put him up in a dorm, but he had to come home and vote. At which point my question is, can you vote in both places? Who is claiming you as a dependent, and where do you truly live? And this is a serious point, and I think Kosick just covered it. Rep Kosick just covered kind of the same thing, that this kind of creates a lot of loopholes. And so my question is, if you want to vote, there, are you solely there, or it's not about their finances, if that has nothing to do with it. It's about whether or not the parents are claiming as a dependent, which means they live in their home city, or do they live in their college city, if you will.
Okay, you're welcome. We have about 30 seconds for an answer. And so, Mr. Burns, if you could answer that, please.
Yeah, so I would say that it seems like you're getting at that, that mostly college students, like I am, I believe, claimed as a dependent under my parents. But I feel like most of that, even though I am living on college campus, but I feel like most of that is because it's unclear of, at least to me, how to change my residence. And then if I do, how that impacts my voting. So I feel like a lot of students default to their parents' residence, even though they want to give their voice and like be heard within the districts that the schools are.
Thank you very much. And Representative Greenman, we are going to go for your closing remarks and go to the vote. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I will use my closing, I think, to correct a few things that Representative Kosnick said. It wasn't about this provision, but the fiscal note is actually $37 million, which is about the amount of money that that Elon Musk made in 2 hours. And I think that is an investment, a small investment in the infrastructure of our democracy and the 3.3 million Minnesotans who voted and the 5.7 million Minnesotans who sent us here to represent them. And it is a campaign finance system that is actually built on small dollar donors. But what we're talking about here in this committee is the importance of young folks being able to participate, 18 to 24 year olds. It is the future of our democracy. And so I really appreciate the testifiers. I appreciate the questions and I ask for your support.
Thank you. And I will renew my motion that House File 9 be, as amended, be referred to the Taxes Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Bernardi.
Aye.
Bernardi, aye. Vice Chair Christensen.
Yes.
Christensen, aye. Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill, no.
O'Neill, no. Representative Albright.
No.
Albright, no. Representative Daniels.
Daniels votes no.
Daniels, nay. Representative Erickson.
Erickson votes no.
Erickson, nay. Representative Hansen.
Hansen, aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Heintzman.
No.
Heintzman, nay. Representative Howard.
Aye.
Howard, aye. Representative Keeler.
Keeler, aye.
Keeler, aye. Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn, aye.
Cleavorn, aye. Representative Kosnick.
No.
Kosnick, nay. Representative Kresha.
No.
Kresha, nay. Representative Mason.
Aye.
Mason, aye. Representative Mekeland.
Mekeland, no.
Mekeland, nay. Representative Noor.
Noor, yes.
Noor, aye. Representative Sandell.
Aye.
Sandell, aye. Representative Sandsted.
Sandsted, yes.
Sandsted, aye. Representative Thompson.
Thompson, yes.
Thompson, aye. There are 10 ayes and 8 nays.
You're muted, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, my technical expert here. There being 10 ayes and 8 nays, the motion passes and House File 9 is referred to the Tax Committee. The meeting is adjourned.